Hello and welcome to episode 36 of Not Reserving Judgment, a podcast about the latest intrigues, triumphs, and outrages in Canadian constitutional law. I'm Josh DeHaas, counsel with the Canadian Constitution Foundation.
I'm Christine Van Gine, the CCF's litigation director.
And I'm Joanna Barron, executive director of the CCF. In today's episode, I'll walk you through a case that challenged COVID travel restrictions out of Newfoundland that is now going to the Supreme Court.
And I'll update you on a surprising hate crime charge that, spoiler alert, has now been dropped.
And we'll share our bad legal takes of the week, where we take a lighthearted look at some legal opinions that didn't quite land. But first, I want to talk a bit about civil disobedience, because the kids these days just don't seem to know what that actually means. So at Columbia earlier this week, students who pay about 60 grand US a year for tuition didn't seem to understand what civil disobedience means. It means more than just breaking the law. It also means accepting the punishment for breaking laws in order to expose the supposed injustice of those laws, thereby inspiring the masses to revolution or to push for the laws to change. And these kids who occupied the building at Columbia on behalf of Hamas were literally whining to the media yesterday about how the school is refusing to provide catering to them while they ransack and occupy a building. And, you know, I'm not kidding. One student really did say this. She wanted them to deliver food, at least for those people whose parents had paid for meal plans. No, kids, that's not what civil disobedience actually looks like. It looks like Gandhi going from village to village in India, encouraging Indians to pick up salt in protest of the colonial rule against producing salt without paying taxes, knowing that he'll go to jail over and over again unless his actions inspire Indians to rise up against the injustice and push out their colonial rulers. It doesn't look like, you know, your meal plan points expiring too soon. The point is, if you're not willing to take the punishment in order to show that the law is unjust, then you're not engaged in true civil disobedience. And that brings me to my headline this week, which is about a woman named Angela Davidson, who goes by Rainbow Eyes with a Z. She's a 38-year-old BC woman who has just been sentenced to 60 days in jail after being convicted for seven counts of contempt of court for blockading roads used for old growth tree logging on Vancouver Island. Now, Rainbow Eyes is technically the deputy leader of the Green Party of Canada, although according to the party's website, she prefers the title Uma Anis, which means high-ranking woman in Kwakwala. And according to CBC, Rainbow Eyes was arrested first in May 2021 after she chained her neck to a gate to prevent forestry operations from going ahead. And this was after the logging company had already gotten an injunction saying that, you know, protesters can't be there and block the road. But she just kept doing it again and again. And I've lamented before that contempt of court hasn't been taken seriously enough by some prosecutors. They've let things drop, even though protesters have like repeatedly blocked pipeline constructions and things like that. But it looks like this time BC prosecutors wanted to make an example out of somebody, and they got their way. They had asked for 51 days in jail for Rainbow Eyes, and the judge actually gave a 60-day sentence. And Rainbow Eyes seems to actually get how civil disobedience is supposed to work. Not only does she say she'll accept her fate, but she told reporters outside the courthouse that she'd do it again because she believes that she's following the natural law. And she says, quote, "There's no price too high to protect Mother Earth, and we know it. This message comes from Mother Earth. It comes from forests and the Amazon, Asia, Africa, to stand up for the trees right now before it's too late." So now this is the part where we get to see where whether other people are, you know, so moved by her particular view of morality that they rise up and elect the Green Party to a majority government and then, you know, ban forestry and repeal the unjust laws that put her in jail. And if that happens, we can add her to a long list of civil rights heroes, from George Mason to Gandhi to MLK to Joshua Wong. But until then, she's just an activist who chained her neck to a fence and refused to leave. Obviously, I support peaceful protests. We've talked about that many times. It's one of our most sacred charter rights, but it doesn't include blockading. And when people blockade, They're taking the law into their own hands, which can't be encouraged in a rule of law society unless, of course, the law is fundamentally unjust. So to me, civil disobedience, you know, it can be morally correct, but you have to be willing to take the legal consequences. And in most cases, it's better to just, you know, organize legal protests. And that includes things like marching the street while not blocking the highway, or gathering outside legislatures and or city hall or Parliament Hill, but not, you know, creating big occupations for weeks on end, which brings me back to these campus protests. So the NYPD, I'm not sure if you saw last night, they went in and they ended the occupation at Columbia. And I saw this tweet from the University of Chicago's president addressing these tensions on campus right now that I thought was pretty good. Basically, he says, you know, you can put up banners that say the most deeply offensive things, because that's what's required for free speech, is that we accept people are going to have really different views. And you might even be able to make like a little encampment for a short period of time, but you can't occupy buildings where other people are trying to learn. You can't make so much noise and so much disruption that you're preventing other people's expression or other people from learning. And I think that's basically correct. You know, you have a right to protest and express yourself and offend and say deeply offensive things, and maybe even inconvenience other people, but you don't have the right to seriously disrupt other people's lives through things like blockades. So that's kind of where I stand on the Columbia protest and this interesting case out of BC. Joanna, Christine, what do you think of this case?
This is like a modern day version of the Antigone tragedy. Do you guys know that? I get to show off my classics background a little bit. So Antigone is one of the Greek tragedies by Sophocles. And it's the story of a girl, Antigone, whose brother Polynices engages in a civil war for the throne of Thebes and loses. And because he's then deemed a traitor, her uncle, Creon, orders that his body be banished and he not be given a proper burial. And the whole plot of the play is just Antigone appealing to the laws and gods of nature rather than the city, in a plea to give her brother a dignified burial. And it's often taught in like political science 101 as like the laws of nature versus the laws of man. And yeah, I would just say, you know, seeking to bury your brother properly is a different thing than seeking to prevent Jewish students or any students in particular, although I'm sure we all saw that clip of the Jewish student at UCLA who was trying to like go across the quad and was being barred by a human wall, which, by the way, guys, bad PR play. Like, he clearly set you up for that. Like, just let the kid through. But anyway, so that clearly is interfering with somebody else's liberty. It's interfering with learning at the university itself. So I would say Antigone is on stronger moral footing, just wanting to bury her poor brother, Polynices. What do you think, Christine?
Yeah, so I obviously am very supportive of the right to protest. It's interesting to watch kind of public opinion change on this issue of the student encampments and protests. I feel like it reminds me of the Freedom Convoy, to be honest. I think at first people are like, yeah, you have a right to protest. And then it's like, we've taken over a building and we demand you deliver us our Uber Eats. The revolution will be catered. And this then swings public opinion against the protests, who at first are like, yeah, of course students protest. Of course they should be allowed to protest a political cause. And even though, you know, I'm supportive of Israel's right to defend itself against the terrorist threat of Hamas, I also am supportive of the right of students to gather and protest against war. This is like one of the most classic student activities of activist students. But it doesn't go so far that you can take over a building and then demand the administration allow your Uber Eats deliveries in. Like, if you chose to blockade yourself into a building, you don't get your Grubhub. Sorry. And then my other sort of reaction to this is to observe the copycat to clarify the analogy to the Freedom Convoy is, I think a lot of people early on with the convoy were like, yeah, we're also really fed up with the mandates, with all of these restrictions that are being placed on it. But as the protest went on for like 3 weeks and continued to blockade blockade core roads in Ottawa, people lost a lot of sympathy. There was no more sympathy for it. So sort of that's the analogy. And like with the Freedom Convoy, which ultimately was breaking laws and needed to be moved because you can't indefinitely blockade property, the Columbia protests and these student protests need to be moved.
Just to get this in, because I know we're going to get mail about this, if we don't clarify this, while the media went hysterical about the one or two sort of nasty pieces of work, the Freedom Convoy, the swastika, whatever, it does seem that a majority, like a good core of these students, are openly pro-terror, right? Like it has not been the odd bad apple that is saying, you know, go back to Poland, burn Tel Aviv to the ground. And so for me, that's like, yeah, I mean, the occupation of the building is stupid. But for me, the much bigger problem is that these kids are apparently, I really don't know how it happened, that Gen Z, some parts of Gen Z seem to be just like a rabidly pro-terror, which has to do with their ideology.
And terribly,
just to clarify,
terribly anti-Semitic, which isn't something that you saw at the Freedom Convoy. And I think in the copycat protests that you've seen at McGill, you've seen a lot of openly anti-Semitic statements being made. Okay, let's turn now to my news headline, which is about a incitement to hatred charge that was announced by police on January 11th and has now, spoiler alert, been dropped. So on January 11th, police announced that they had arrested a 41-year-old man named Mahaid Sameh Hilal Al-Khalaf. And they charged him with incitement for hatred for carrying the flag of a terrorist organization. This was the flag of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP. So he had allegedly marched down Bay Street and Queen West as part of a pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel protest on January 7th. And the police announced the charges on January 11th. They originally refused to say what the charges, what flag he was flying, but CBC News confirmed it was this PFLP flag, which is a Palestinian Marxist-Leninist terror group. They were, you know, they're really notorious. They had been hijacking commercial airliners in the 1960s and 70s. And these terror attacks targeted civilians, obviously. The hijackings targeted civilians. They also directly attacked civilians with suicide bombs, shootings, and engaged in assassinations. So they are not a good group. They're listed terrorist organization on the federal government terror organization list, and they call for the destruction of the state of Israel and the establishment of a communist government in Palestine. So when this arrest first happened, a lot of things had been going on at the time there that were extremely terrifying to Canadians, especially for Jewish Canadians, sort of echoing the horrors of Kristallnacht. These Jewish businesses had been targeted with violence, having their windows smashed. Synagogues have had their windows broken. A Jewish deli in North York was burned in a suspected arson. The words Free Palestine spray painted onto it. At my own subway station here in Toronto, someone had drawn a Star of David with an X through it on the floor. Racial slurs against Jews have been drawn on a streetcar stop sign downtown. I won't use the words that were written, but they were very awful. And this arrest also happened at the same time that this blockade of the bridge at Avenue Road and the 401 was taking place with a protest, an anti-Israel, pro-Palestine protest. And that bridge blockade blocked one of the only two entrances into this Jewish community in North Toronto. So it seemed like the site was chosen specifically for the reason of blockading this particular community. So when this was all the context around this flag arrest. So the man was arrested, Mr. Al-Khalaf was arrested for carrying this flag. But when it happened, you know, I was concerned by this charge because I didn't think it met the threshold for incitement. And I said so publicly. I had an article that I wrote for the McDonald Laurier Institute, which said that, you know, we had seen weeks of underreacting to the concerns of the Jewish community by police. And now police seem to be responding to this flag incident in a way that was unjustifiably limiting speech, even though I do think that flying that flag, that terrorist flag, is obviously repugnant. So I think perhaps flying the flag should trigger some type of investigation by CSIS to determine, you know, where this undercurrent of support for terrorism is coming from. And if there is a larger concern here, I think that violence and support for terror is a real threat to Canadian security and should be taken seriously. But just flying a flag, I don't know if it meets the criteria for incitement to hatred, which is in the criminal code under section 319 sub 1. So that criminal code prohibition prohibits communicating statements in a public place to incite hatred against any identifiable group where such incitement is likely to lead to a breach of the peace. And I talk about in this article an analogy to, you know, the Nazi flag, because both the Nazis and the PFLP are anti-Semitic. They are both genocidal. But, you know, flying the Nazi flag is actually not a criminal offense under section 319 sub 1, unless it's combined with intent to incite hatred that could lead to a breach of the peace. Obviously, I condemn flying both flags. They're both terrible things to do. But we know that there have been many cases across Canada over the years where people have flown reprehensible flags. And without that broader context, charges have not been laid. So in order to successfully prosecute for incitement, in this case of this PFLP flag, a judge is going to need to rely on evidence and context from the protest itself to determine whether Al-Khalaf's intention was to target an identifiable group like Jews, for example, or if it was, you know, a statement about capitalism, since it's a Marxist group, or the West as a whole, or if he had some other intention. And I think when you look at the facts coming from the handful of cases on public incitement to hatred, section 319.1, the handful of cases that have resulted in a conviction, I think that this case has an uphill, was going to have an uphill battle. So there are a number of cases. There's one called R and Renberg, one called R and Tetu, one called R and Ryu, R and MG, and Dion. And these all had very, very clear nexuses to violence. So the Renberg case from Nova Scotia in 2010, the accused was convicted of incitement because he literally went to the home of an interracial couple and burned a cross on the front lawn of their home, I believe, and shouted racial slurs and called for their death in front of them and their five children. So look, I get that it's very uncomfortable to think that it is not a criminal act for Al-Khalaf to wave the flag of a terrorist group that wouldn't, you know, hesitate to blow all of us up, that it wouldn't hesitate to hijack a civilian airplane or use a suicide bomb, just as it's very uncomfortable to think that flying a Nazi flag isn't a criminal offense. But as it turns out, we now have an update on this case. And my initial reaction to the story, it seems like it was correct, because the charge against Al-Khalaf, this man who flew the flag, it has been withdrawn. And CBC has reported that Al-Khalaf's lawyer told media that the charge was withdrawn by the Crown because there was no reasonable prospect of conviction. And his lawyer said that the case hinged on the flag belonging to a group listed by the federal government as a terrorist group, which it does. But he said that in and of itself isn't enough evidence for a conviction, which is exactly what I said in the McDonald Laurier Institute article. And the lawyer then went on, though, to say that it shows the police acted not on a legal basis, but a political basis. So I think all of this seems right, but it seems like what I predicted would happen, which is unfortunate because I don't want to make a murder of this man. So, Josh, any reaction to either part of this, my reaction?
I remember this happening and we were both kind of like, okay, yeah, how is this incitement to violence? And
I did say, I did say I give the police the benefit of the doubt. Maybe there was more happening at the protest than we know about, and that the context does matter when doing something like this. Maybe there's more that we didn't know, but as it turns out, doesn't seem like there was.
Yeah, the context matters, but I was listening to a podcast recently, and it was talking about how they deal with like cross burnings in the US, because burning a cross is undoubtedly expression. Like, it's deeply offensive to people, but it does mean different things depending on the context. And in the US, there's a case where they were KKK, but I'm not sure, they burned a cross in the middle of a field, and lots of people saw it, and they were, you know, offended and scared, because like, obviously, that's a really offensive thing to do. But that was protected speech that couldn't be, you know, criminalized. Whereas in the US, if you go to someone's house and you put a cross on their lawn and you light that on fire, that's not protected speech. That's just a crime. Like, you're directly threatening someone. You know, there's like a short step from there to violence. Like, it is like a threat in a sense, right, of violence. And that's what the difference is, you know, a burning a cross in the middle of a field is expression, and you're not threatening any particular person. Whereas if you go to someone's house and put a cross on their lawn and burn it, obviously you're threatening them. So I thought that was interesting, because one of the few hate crime cases where there's a conviction in Canada was burning a cross on someone's lawn, which is a crime regardless of whether it's speech, because you're threatening that person. Joanna, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I don't really have much to add. I'm glad to see that your instincts, Christine, were vindicated, and that there needs to be a more specific nexus. And I also think it's important to emphasize that the reason why we're so protective of speech acts is so that people can express their repugnant ideas via speech, and we can preserve sort of a maximally open society. I've been thinking a lot about, and I'm probably going to write something about this. A friend of mine, maybe 5 years ago, wrote a book called Mere Civility. Her name is Teresa Bejan. And it writes about how the idea of free speech and open discourse is not that everybody is nice and necessarily accepting of other people's nasty viewpoints, but just that as long as we're still in conversation, even if we're being nasty to each other, even if we're shouting at each other, and this is in the context of like early American Puritans, can't remember the name of the guy. She talks about this like early pilgrim who was like a real nasty piece of work. But like, he was like, the whole point of free speech is that I can be as nasty as possible as long as I'm not holding a sword. And so one thing that we've really learned in the last 6 months is some libertarians seem to think that denouncing hateful speech means like being soft on terrorism. No, it's exactly the opposite. It's we want speech, which is the only peaceful way we have of resolving our differences and our conflicting points of view, to be open. But we also want to know who the people are who are, you know, in public holding a terrorist flag. You know, not just us, the public should be aware of that, but like law enforcement should be aware of that. Not so they can arrest him for carrying the flag, so that they can keep an eye on him. What else is he doing, right? Because if you start materially supporting a terrorist group, that's a different story.
Yeah, that's why I said in my original op-ed about this that there's good cause for CSIS to be concerned if someone's marching around with a terrorist flag.
Yeah.
Well, let's move now, Joanna, to your news headline.
Okay. Well, let's take a break first. When we come back, I will tell you about Kim Taylor and her case with Just Scott Leave.
Hi, I'm Russell from the CCF. In case you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to our email newsletter, The Freedom Update, to get updates from me every week about our ongoing work and the legal stories in Canada that keep us interested. Along with our new podcast, Not Reserving Judgment, it's one of the best ways to stay up to date. Subscribe at theccf.ca/freedomupdate.
Okay, so this is a case that just we found out got leave last week from the Supreme Court of Canada. It's the case of Kim Taylor. And this is one of the first instances early in the first wave of the pandemic, when I was saw just clear instance of governments doing things that were clearly constitutionally shady. In just what way, I guess, is why this is going to the Supreme Court. But I'll tell you a little bit about the factual background and then what is going to be argued, it looks like, at the Supreme Court. So this is a woman named Kim Taylor. Her mother passed away in May 2020 in Newfoundland. Kim lived in Nova Scotia, and knowing that there were quarantine and border restrictions because the Maritime provinces locked down their provincial borders, unlike other provinces in Canada, she immediately started quarantining, and she devised a plan to safely be able to attend her mother's funeral. She set up a quarantine location where she could have food delivered through the back door. She arranged with the funeral home director to schedule the funerals in the days after she had already quarantined for 14 days. And then she submitted an exemption form requesting to enter Newfoundland because Newfoundland was then closed to all non-residences. And the government denied her requests. They invoked an act that they had brought in April of 2020 called the Public Health Protection and Promotion Act, which limited entry to residents, asymptomatic workers, and those in quote unquote extenuating circumstances. And it turned out those extenuating circumstances did not extenuate to attending the funeral of your parent, shockingly. So Taylor launched a legal challenge. She was supported by the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. And at the application stage, at the first stage, there were two main arguments. The first was that it was a violation of Newfoundland of the division of powers because interprovincial travel is traditionally a matter of federal concern, which makes sense, right? Because things that cross provincial borders almost by definition transcend provincial jurisdiction. And that argument didn't get much uptake. I remember at the time, journalists, I thought that was a strong argument. I still think it's a strong argument. At the time, Dominic LeBlanc sort of brushed it off. I got the sense that just politically, the feds did not want to interfere with this. But it didn't get much attention or countenance at the application stage. And the other set of arguments was around Section 6, which is the section of the Charter that guarantees mobility of citizens. So I'll just break down the two parts of Section 6 briefly, because this looks like this is going to be the main game at the Supreme Court of Canada hearing. So Section 6 sub 1 says every citizen of Canada has the right to enter, remain in, and leave Canada. And sub 2 says every citizen of Canada and every person who has the status of a permanent resident of Canada has the right A, to move to and take up residence in any province, and B, to pursue the gaining of a livelihood in any province. So at the application stage, the trial court found that Kim Taylor's Section 6 sub 1, so that's the right to enter, remain in, and leave Canada, that right was violated, but it was justified under Section 1, the limitation clause. And this is a little suspect given that every other province in Canada was able to weather the first wave without such draconian measures. And certainly there were less intrusive options like mandatory 14-day quarantines, which Taylor was willing to submit to. Overall, just very cruel treatment. And I know that this happened to many people in this period. There's a friend of ours named Jackie Delaney, whose father passed away, and she was living in Ottawa, and she could not travel to New Brunswick to be actually at his deathbed. So he passed away in a hospital with his partner and without any of his children by his side. Very tragic. But anyways, so at the Supreme Court, sorry, I know it's sort of sad to go back to these very sad human circumstances and then go right back to constitutional analysis. So the Newfoundland Court of Appeal denied leave to hear this case, or sorry, they declared it moot, even though both the government of Newfoundland and Taylor, as well as the Civil Liberties Association, wanted an answer on what exactly Section 6 protects. Newfoundland court basically said it's moot, even though it's possible that future public health emergencies could come up. They will be materially different from the COVID-19 pandemic. So anything we say now about the scope of rights will be irrelevant in the case of a future pandemic. So kind of, I think, just tossing a political hot potato. So the Supreme Court granted leave. And the issue essentially is, does Section 6 protect a right to interprovincial travel? Now, it's important to note that both the government as well as Taylor agree that if there is such a right, and Taylor and CCLA say there is, it's not contained in Section 6.1, enter, remain, and leave Canada. Everybody agrees that the application judge fumbled that. The CCLA, though, is saying that Section 2A, which says in English, the right to move to and take up residence in any province, does protect a right to interprovincial travel. And I think their most, one of their most compelling and interesting arguments in favor for this is to look at the French text of Section 2 sub A. So in French, it says, toute citoyenne et toute personne ayant le statut de résident en le droit, and here's the important part, and I will break this down for those of you who don't speak French, de se déplacer dans tout le pays. So déplacer basically means like to move around, to get around, to travel. It's not the same verb as déménager, which is to move to, because the government's position and the other position is when we say you have the right to move to and take up residence in any province, we're saying you have the right to pack up a U-Haul and go and move to another place. That's a different proposition from to move around. And clearly, déménager is the verb that would mean to move to, U-Haul style, in French. So we'll see what different arguments are going to be made. I should say we don't want to get too much into the merits of the various arguments because the CCF is considering also applying for leave in this case. And it'll be interesting to see what the court wants to do and why they granted leave to this case. This is one of the few remaining COVID era cases that we're still going to get answers on. So Josh, what do you think? I know we've been talking about these various arguments. Any preliminary thoughts?
Yeah, I'm really excited that we're intervening in this case because what happened to the person involved, Ms. Taylor, is outrageous and is really arbitrary to have, you know, public health officers decide, okay, this person can come into the province because, like, I think one of the people on the list was, you know, someone who loses their job in another province and then wants to move in with their parents, they can go to Newfoundland. But somebody whose, you know, parent has died and their, you know, other parent needs emotional support, so for some reason this unelected person is able to decide they can't enter the province. So I really hate the arbitrariness of that, and I'm glad to see that CCLA is pushing back, and the Section 6 arguments, like, they seem pretty strong to me. I'm excited to hear those. I always also thought that the division of powers arguments were strong. You know, interprovincial works and undertakings are carved out from Section 92. So, you know, when you build like a highway in Ontario or Alberta or whatever, that's provincial jurisdiction. But as soon as you're connecting two provinces, whether it's ferries, which is actually in a different part of the Section 91, or you're building a bridge or a railroad or even like an airline route, that's an interprovincial undertaking, and that's exclusive federal jurisdiction. So I find it funny that this law, this public health law, says that the medical officer of health can just ban travel to the entire province. And it's like, how can you do that without completely overtaking this federal jurisdiction? So I always thought that was like a strong argument, but it looks like this is all going to be about Section 6. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, like, there has to be some mobility right between provinces, because Confederation wouldn't make a whole lot of sense otherwise. And yeah, excited to see where it goes next. Christine, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm also interested in pre-Confederation or pre-charter rights to mobility and to move around. So I'm just so happy that the Supreme Court has finally granted leave to a case that is interesting for us. There has really been a decline in the number of cases that have been granted leave to the Supreme Court. Usually we try to appear at the Supreme Court a couple of times a year in interventions, and with the number of leaves they've been granting, that opportunity has really shrunk. So we have not been granted leave yet to intervene in this case, but we are going to be seeking it. And this is a whole thing that, Joanna, in our book, you wrote a whole chapter about
Oh yeah, I forgot to mention our book.
Wait, yeah. You have a book? What is the name of this book? I've never heard of this.
Pandemic Panic.
Nominated for the Donner Prize to be announced on May 8th.
So Joanna has a whole section about this exact case in the book. So I think of all of the organizations in Canada that are positioned to have some expertise in the issue of mobility, which it's a really novel question, the question of your ability to move between provinces. Previously, mobility issues under Section 6 all dealt with your right to enter the country, not your right to enter specific provinces. So the province issue is really a novel question. And we are one of the few organizations that has written about this in our book. So I'm pretty excited to see what happens next. Let's move on now to our bad legal takes. And we'll start with you, Josh.
All right. So my bad legal take goes to Minister of Immigration Mark Miller for claiming that he couldn't respond to Toronto MP Kevin Wong's question about a really important legal matter that's in the public interest and that a lot of Canadians, including me, are, you know, pretty outraged about and trying to get answers on. So MP Wong asked Miller in question period about the minister's apparent decision to block the deportation of a Pakistani international student from Canada, despite the fact that this guy has been arrested 10 times and convicted for blockading roads and bridges in British Columbia on behalf of the extremist climate change group Extinction Rebellion, and I think also his own activist group, which is aimed at saving old growth forests. Miller responded to MP Wong's question by saying he can't publicly talk about this matter, and his office has said the same thing, citing privacy laws, even though many times in the past, ministers have talked about specific immigration cases with no problem where it's in the public interest. And, you know, I say that this is the minister's apparent intervention because he has refused to confirm that he really did intervene on humanitarian grounds, even though that's basically the only explanation that immigration lawyers have been able to come up with. All we know for sure is that Liberal MP Joyce Murray's office called this guy and said that the basically said, stay by your phone. And then he got a call from immigration saying that his deportation wasn't going to go ahead. And according to the local newspaper, which is Glacier Media, the man involved has, you know, he's blocked rail lines and bridges, like I said. And it also seems like he, as a student, never actually went to university. And so the deportation might also be related in some way to that. But anyway, after getting a non-answer from Miller, MP Wong tweeted that he wanted to know, quote, what's so special about this person? What connections do they have that they can get their MP or minister to throw out our legal and immigration systems like that? What does the Trudeau government have to gain? Was this politically motivated? And like I said, we don't know for sure because the minister is not talking, but I wouldn't put it past them for this to be politically motivated because Trudeau does seem to like eco-activists who break laws. Like he made one of them, Stephen Guilbeault, who was famously arrested for his climate activism. He made him the Minister of Environment, and Trudeau also, you know, took the opportunity to do a photo op with Greta Thunberg, who is the teenage climate activist. Oh, she might be an adult now, actually, who is taking a break from joining the people gluing their hands to the roads in Germany to, you know, do PR for Hamas. And call me old fashioned, but, you know, if you come to Canada, you are on a student visa and then you refuse to go to school and break the law over and over and over again, you probably should be deported, especially if you've had all of your days in court and appeals. But apparently this Liberal government disagrees and they won't really tell us why. So my bad legal take is that the tenuous one that you shouldn't use privacy laws to dodge important questions like this. Christine, what's your bad legal take?
Okay, so my bad legal take is actually sort of a group of things that are kind of all related to each other. But I realize that These are more like criticisms of police operational decisions than actual legal takes, but I still want to talk about it anyway, because I've been thinking about them a lot. And it sort of relates to the headline as well. Mr. Al-Khalaf, who was charged by police, and ultimately the Crown had to drop those charges, and how in his case, there was this lead up of underreaction by police to potential criminal acts taking place at these pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel events. There was an underreaction that then the pendulum swung to this overreaction in Mr. Al-Khalaf's case, where there was this criminal charge that didn't meet the threshold, even though his conduct was reprehensible. So the thing I want to talk about today as my BLT are these two other police operational decisions that I have a problem with, even though, as I say, they're not quite a legal take. And the first is this decision in New Brunswick by police to stop investigating gas theft, people who fill their gas tank and then drive off. I think it's called gas and dash, or fuel and flee, or something like that. And apparently it is quite a problem in New Brunswick, but the police have not been doing anything about it for quite a while. And it puts these gas stations in a really difficult spot, because these are small businesses. A lot of them are franchises or even independently owned. And so the stolen fuel comes out of their pocket. And these are often, you know, families who own these gas stations. And police in New Brunswick say that they're not going to be investigating because they're under-resourced and they need to focus on other things, so they can't investigate these crimes. And this is actually seems to be consistent with the theme we're seeing in Toronto related to car thefts. You know, if your car is stolen, it's probably a lost cause. The police are not going to find it. They're probably hardly even going to try. Then the other police operational decision I want to talk about is this awful story about a robbery of an LCBO, a liquor store, in Bowmanville, which is a town in eastern Ontario, just east of Oshawa. So officers with Durham Police, which is, I guess, who polices Bowmanville, they responded to a robbery at an LCBO location in the early evening, around 7:50. It was an off-duty officer who witnessed the robbery of the LCBO and called it in. And according to the police, it was a male suspect who, as part of the robbery, he brandished a knife. And that's when the off-duty officer alerted Durham Police. The Durham Police showed up and the suspect fled, and they pursued him in a vehicle chase. They followed him throughout Durham on local streets. But then, in an attempt to lose the police, the thief went the wrong way onto the 401, the major highway running through that region. And while driving wrong way, speeding down the highway, he crashed, and there was a 6-vehicle collision. The police had pursued him onto the highway in the wrong direction. And tragically, he crashed into a van carrying a baby, an infant, and the baby's grandparents, and killed all three of them. And this is, you know, the stuff of nightmares for me. It is really horrible. I can't imagine how this family is feeling. And sort of the theme coming out of this is, like, I just wish that the police could get the balance right. I understand that they have a really difficult job, but these are all stories about police first underreacting, you know, not arresting people for committing crimes at protests, not arresting people for persistent thefts at LCBOs or gas stations, and then overreacting by following the car onto the highway going the wrong direction. Like, operationally, I of course think the police should pursue thefts. And I admit that I am not an expert, but I think it's probably the wrong operational choice to pursue a car speeding the wrong way onto the highway. It is just not worth a family dying. There will be an investigation by Special Investigation Unit, so we'll see what they say. But to me, this is this persistent theme of, you know, doing too little and then doing too much. Joanna, how about you?
Okay, my bad legal take of the week goes to this tweet. So the traditional council of Kahnawake has confirmed that students of McGill, have the right to be on this land and to their encampment. We are happy to see, this is a statement, we are happy to see that students within universities and colleges are occupying their campuses in solidarity with the massacred Palestinians. Any and all war and military actions are intrinsic with the most primitive and lower levels of human thought. Another interesting thing about this statement is that all of the names of the different nations, like they named the two-row Wampan Peace Treaty, those are all capitalized, and all references to Europe, Canada, Israel, they're all lowercase. So interesting stylistic choice. But anyways, okay. Traditional Council of Kahnawake confirms that you have the right to occupy McGill campus, and McGill administration should heed that. Okay. Fine. You granted them permission. That's great. I accept it. I will just note that if you want to go down this Indigenous first inhabitants of the land line, you may lead you to places that are going to be a little difficult for you to explain, because I'm pretty sure if you go back before the British Mandate and the Ottoman Empire and the Roman Empire, you will find that the first continuous settlement in the Holy Land was the Judean Kingdom. It's almost like that's not actually the point. And I will paraphrase, not to be named, a friend of ours who's an Ojibwe woman who said her hot take with Israel is that it is the ultimate example of land back to Indigenous people in modern history. So thank you for granting permission, but I'm not sure if this line of argument is going to work out for you.
All right, so that's the end of the show. As usual, we hope you'll rate us, review us, and subscribe. And just a reminder, you can support our work by subscribing to the Canadian Constitution Foundation's YouTube channel, by following us on X, or by visiting our website, theccf.ca, where you can sign up for our Freedom Update newsletter from our colleague, Russ. The CCF is a nonpartisan legal charity funded by donations, so please go to our website and click the blue donate button if you can. Thanks for listening.